Good afternoon and welcome to the Living Writer Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm Amanda Yulee, your once in a while host, though it has been a little bit too long since I've been here. I'm here in our Ann Arbor studio with my longtime friend, celebrated writer and activist, National Book Award and Pulitzer Prize finalist, Newbery Medal winner, founder of McSweeney's, and co-founder of the 826 Network of Youth Writing Centers, and honestly, way too many more books and organizations and projects to mention. He has a brilliant new novel out this spring, Contrapposto, and we'll spend this hour talking about that book and more. Welcome to the show, Dave Eggers.
Thank you, Amanda. Good job. That was very smooth.
Thank you.
I have not witnessed you doing this in person. It's very... very seamless.
Well, that was my first question. How will we do? We talk on the phone all the time, but I have yet
never done this. I don't think
speak to you on a microphone with headphones.
You got Frank over there figuring everything out.
He's
making
on
sure
it.
It's all as long as the red light's on, we're good. We got the red light. All right, good.
We're good. We're good.
Now we're recording.
No, we talk all the time, and this will be a fun talk about your new novel, the brilliant Contrapposto. I love it so much. I tell you this a lot, but I'm excited for its release. This show will air in June on its release week.
Nice. Good thinking.
Yeah, we're ahead of things here. at the Living Writers Show. And then you
and I are
doing some events together. So we will, this is like the first of a few conversations.
Yeah, and I think I'll be back here in 2 months, which is really weird. I think I was telling my son just how many times I've been in Ann Arbor in the last 20 years, and it's a lot for one place.
For one spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're honorary semi-citizen of Ann Arbor.
You know your way around. You know the record store.
I don't have to pay taxes yet, but they would have a claim, like, I think.
I think so, too. I think so, too. Well, we've been talking about this novel. I feel like you and I have been talking about this novel for a very long time, but that's nothing compared to how long you've been thinking about it and working on it. Do you want to talk about where it started?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it. With a lot of things, there's like a very long gestation period. I mean, there's things I take notes on and that they don't come to fruition for 20 years. So this is one of those. I grew up as a wannabe art student, let's say, and then I went in a different direction eventually. But, you know, you store away a lot of thoughts and memories and notes and questions. And so I always thought it would be interesting to talk about, more so than the art world itself or art school itself or anything, with two friends going through that world together. And as that Howard Jones song indicates, it's two friends that they meet when they're eight. And they're not always successfully together romantically. So I use that song, I mentioned it in the book, and now only now hearing it was I realizing, like, oh, one of the reasons that you mention is because it's about this unrequited love, but it's also a song that if you grew up in the 80s, it was everywhere for about 45 years. And I always thought it was such a strange song to be such a big hit because it's so sad.
It's bleak.
It's so bleak and grim and sort of when you're 14 and you hear this song 40 times a day, this is like the main picture of love and romance and what you have to look forward to sort of that was presented to us, which is like a very sophisticated, very melancholy and bleak look. This is what you have to look forward to. So, you know, I think we're going to play four or five other songs that are mentioned in the book. And that one was just, there's a handful of songs that are just, they were inevitable outside of the music that you yourself would choose. But this is the music that while you're working or in the mall or it's on the radio or whatever, it was just unavoidable.
Well, that song, you know, listening to it again in this context, it is pretty bleak. It's pretty sad. But the novel isn't to me at all. Oh. I mean, do you think, how do you see it?
No, no. Yeah. No, there was not at all. I mean,
it's
think
joyful.
That I definitely didn't want to make it. So there's two characters, Cricket and Olympia, and they meet when they're 8 and 9 years old. And then we sort of follow them through life until they're in their 70s. And the book sort of jumps ahead here and there. Every section maybe jumps ahead about 10 years. And I never wanted to make it like this, you know, sorrowful statement about one person forever in love with the other and never having a chance at you know, that coming to fruition. It's really like they're both very accepting of kind of moving in and out of their each other's lives over mm-hmm. time. And and I think that I wanted to write about friendship over time because I've had mostly the same friends since grade school, and you acquire new friends, which is great. But and then I think that one thing that I don't read a lot about is friends between men and women over decades, which is like so common and so normal, but it's somehow in fiction and film, it's so rare, you know, like you even, I remember that sort of, you know, when you see it in a TV show, like they'd have to make it a big deal, like that it's like, you know,
a
show
yeah.
they have to call platonic to just like underline this can happen. It will. And even then they have to create all this tension about it, which is so strange because it really should be in this century. It really should not be something that we have to like think is so rare and strange and fraught. I mean, I guess when Harry Met Sally kind of wrecked it for everybody to sort of think that it can be normal. But I'm saying that even though these two do end up being, you know, romantic here and there. But but I do think it was really kind of fun to jump ahead 10 years. And when you know somebody from grade school, there's such a shorthand and you feel like you know that person better than anybody and they can pick up right where they left off. But also there's a resentment that you get sometimes with somebody that knows you from, they know everything. They know about the thing that happened even in second grade that you wish it had
you
forgotten.
You got in trouble or you did this embarrassing thing. Yeah.
Wet your pants in the middle of language lab. I wouldn't know anything about that.
That's
but
not a story
about
you. I know
it happened to somebody at some point. They know your old nicknames that you don't want anyone else to know. And so there's that tension between, you know, this is who I am now. We're going to forget that little part there, this part there. But there's that immense comfort of familiarity and just sort of like the decades that you have together. And so I'm back in the Midwest right now looking at schools with my son and get to see all my old friends from grade school and high school. And I was with two old friends that I've known since I was 10 in Evanston, and just seeing my son see us, watch us, like the way that the banter works is so like lightning quick, and just trying to, I'm just seeing him absorb that. And maybe picture what his friends now are going to, you know, how they're going to be 40 years from now. But I wanted to sort of, so I think the banter between Cricket and Olympia is quite barbed in a lot of places. And, but I think that, hopefully people that have had those old friends can identify with that a little bit and recognize, how, you don't need to play nice in some places. You can be quite honest with each other. And it comes from a place of love, but I feel like sometimes they struggle, and Cricket struggles with loving Olympia over all these decades, but every so often wanting to shake free of some of her assumptions and presumptions about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, that long-term relationship, I think, is so interesting because, as you were saying, in fiction and film, very often we're working up to a moment, and it's like, that's the culmination, the eye contact, the touching the hand under the table. And you have those, they keep going throughout the book. And so as a writer, I'm interested in the momentum that you built. Mm. They're still building, you know, decade after decade, that tension is there, that connection. I mean, how did you put that together? It's a page turn. It's a longer book, but absolutely you can't stop reading when you start because it has that propulsion.
Well, it doesn't have the, I don't think it has a traditional shape, right? Where you build up to whatever, they get married and then they, you know,
right,
it falls apart or anything like that. Not to spoil anything, but let's say they, you know, I think that most people's lives are utterly shapeless. They don't have a apex where, you know, the love is, you know, reaches this one point and then it's very easily described and it descends, or there's no easy geometric shape to anybody's life, whether you're married or not, or with an old friend or a group of friends or anybody or any. So I think, you know, when you see like a film that was very honest about like the many, many stages of life between two people, and that they, you're, and how sort of, you know, knowing somebody as these people do for 65 years, it's going to have a, you know, like the Henry James expression, like a big baggy monster, right? Mm-hmm. That he would describe how a novel, you know, is shaped. And I tried to give it some structure in that I think it's seven different sections of their lives that are discrete, and there's sort of discrete chapters that you can sort of, are standalone moments between these two. And I kind of feel like you can put them in any order and they still, you'll still recognize the same people. But I hadn't really thought about it that way. Now that you say it, like there isn't a one moment where everything changes or whatever, but there's seven moments or seven stages
at
of
least.
Life where pretty significant things happen, and how do they react to them together, and how do they push through together in these stages of their life. And in between, there's quite a lot of time when they're apart, which I think is what we witness in the book, is the times that they're together, because then they might not see each other for 5-10 years. And you sort of, as a reader, have to fill in between, which I always love doing that as a reader. I love it when books jump forward and give me, as a reader, a role to play to sort of like fill in between. And it's not so difficult. The reader can do it. They don't need their hand held. And sometimes as authors, we forget how smart readers are. Not that we forget, but that we feel like we have to explain every last thing, which is really not the case. You really can.
No readers want that.
They
do
really,
not want it at all explained.
Sometimes like a, whatever, in the movie world, an executive will expect you to, you know, or want you to explain every last thing. And I think every year it's getting a little bit more that way, you know.
Explainy, you mean?
Well, and then, you know, that there was an actor that was talking about how one of the streaming executives, I won't name which streamer, but they expect the plot to be retold to the viewer every 10 minutes, like basically look at the camera and say, this is a movie about a bank heist and here's where we are with the bank. I mean, and truly you will get those notes for sure with any film, but book readers are a different breed. And I think that it's such a participatory process, like a reader, that chemistry between a reader and a book, where they're really participants in it. You know, they're the cinematographer of the book. They're sort of filling in all of these spaces. You can sometimes just gesture at something and they totally understand what's going on. And so it's been nice to see with this book, early readers totally understand these two.
Get it.
And they get it. And I don't have to over-explain a whole lot. And a lot of things I was, as a writer, sometimes you're checking after you're done. You're like, did this come through or did I need to? No, it was all kind of intuited. And so those are the most satisfying experiences, I think, when you can do as little as you want to do and the reader will sort of infer and fill in and complete and color in and, you know, all of those things.
Well, no shade to film, but film is something you usually sit and watch in 2 hours. And with a book, you're spending so many more hours away from it. You read it and then you go away and your mind is working and kind of enjoying, you know, the story in different layered ways. So,
yeah, you know, that's a really good point. I read in the mornings for about an hour, hour and a half, and then the whole day happens in between. You come back, you have to settle back in and remember where you were, but you're bringing all, everything that happened to you in between to it. But I think we're on the both of the opinion that this is the premier art form that humans can
create. We both
create.
Like yes. books. Yeah. I mean, is that a thing that we have in common?
Everything else is a very, very distant second. Mm-hmm. No offense to Frank and music.
Frank.
Music,
Frank.
We both love music, but...
Film, music, yes.
It's...
books are different.
I really do think that, I've had a very banal, but I had to write it down sort of thought, like if I were talking to young people that were skeptical about books, like it is time travel for sure. Mm-hmm. It is a multiverse. To put it in sort of maybe terms that a sci-fi movie fan would like, you're for sure living multiple lives.
Yeah.
You're absolutely time traveling. I'm reading a book right now that takes place in sort of like 1930s Paris, and I'm 100% there. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that I've lived in this time because of this book. I understand every like fabric of that time and feel really, and I spend a lot of time in the turn, you know, late 1800s San Francisco in the last couple of years reading dozens of books from that era too. And so I think that the participatory part of reading is, I think, sort of undersold or underrated because it's everything else is presented to you. I mean, at least film is given to you. You don't participate in film.
Yeah,
you're really passive. But with books, you're at least 50% of the work is being done by you.
It's the whole difference between reading something on your phone and reading something, you know, in a book. Right? It's that.
No one would read on their phone, would they? Do people do that?
Read books on their phone?
Yeah, that shouldn't
be
legal.
Of course they do.
I thought that was banned.
Yeah, we're going to ban it next year.
This
but first,
really
we're
bad.
Going to hear the next song that
How
you
chose.
How could
you read a book on your phone? Isn't
people
it, like,
do it all
too small?
Am I the first person telling you that people have read books on their phone?
I never know anything.
Yeah.
I know about the Kindle and stuff, but that's like much
bigger
type. Well,
not your
type.
Phone. Your phone is not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but even an iPhone, it would seem to me to be way too small, that type. But I mean, I have,
people do
you
it.
Know, I'm totally agnostic. If it's all you can do and you don't have, you're traveling and I have older friends that are in their 80s, they can't carry a bunch of books around. So I'm whatever works, but we do know that
not for
reading
me,
on paper is
superior. Yes.
For sure superior. And you retain a lot more for sure, but whatever you can do, it's all fine.
Better for you. Shall we have Frank cue up the next song?
Say if we up and ran away from the roaring crowd and the worn out city faces, would they carry on at all when they found out we were gone, or would they let us go? Would they tag along, or would they know to leave us alone? Alone, we'd maybe just fine. Happy in a one-room shack, and we'd not look back. Now would we?
All right, this is the Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm Amanda Yulee, hosting today with Dave Eggers. We're here to talk about Contrapposto. We just listened to one more of the song selections, which was decidedly bleak. Thank you for bringing that energy to the Living Writers Show, Dave.
I think that song actually, it does have a maybe positive message. It was written by Paul Williams. If you remember, like he wrote a ton of songs in the 70s. And he was on every variety show. He was kind of like a shaggy-haired, smaller guy with big glasses. And And I'd never heard this song. I buy a lot of like vinyl for a dollar and bins and stuff, and so I can experiment and I'll see a record.
Sounds like
with
my
a
husband
cover.
Who's yeah. across the way here.
So yep. I'd never, I hadn't heard Helen Reddy since the early, maybe late 70s and I Am Woman and, you know, and then I saw that record for a buck and I bought it and I came across that song, which I thought was really, really pretty. And I look for sort of extremely pretty passages and songs, and I thought that had a really nice melody. And it's about what if they were, two people were kind of leave society and run away, what would they say? Could we do it? Could we build a life somewhere apart from all of this?
A lot of Americans are thinking about
yeah,
that right
I mean,
now.
Right?
So, yeah,
so I
that's
thought,
not the worst idea.
It's a favorite of Cricket's grandfather, Silas, who has Cricket sort of play records for him at the beginning of the book. And I thought that would be a very Silas type of song.
A very Silas selection.
The right era and everything. But I still, I like it a lot.
Well, I want to ask you about Silas. You know, people will understand, are already understanding this book that you've written, Contrapposto, about to be about two people. And it is about Cricket and Olympia. But I think we really meet Cricket in many ways through Silas, his grandfather, through Cricket's mother. You know, I think all these people are shaping him and teaching him how to love and how to connect.
Yeah, I mean, he's a kid. He's an only child that grows up in sort of rural Indiana in the 70s and 80s. And his mother has a very annoying to Cricket boyfriend or a semi-stepdad figure in the house. And but so that's the grandfather, Silas, lives in the basement in sort of like this florid kind of humid jungle that's in the Midwest in the middle of winter. He keeps this sort of kind of hothouse atmosphere, and Cricket just gets to draw on the floor next to him and sort of create worlds on the page, whether it's space or dragons or whatever he likes to draw. So, and sort of, you know, Silas early on kind of gives him the tools to survive forces outside himself that are that he can't control, let's say, you know, comparing the stepdad or the boyfriend to the weather. This is just, these are conditions outside that you would dress for or avoid, or, you know, this isn't, and I think it's a lesson to anybody dealing with life.
It takes most people many more years to learn that lesson, that there are things you just have to roll with and that they're just existing conditions.
Yeah, right? You put on a coat, you know, it's like there's the old Scandinavian saying, there's no bad weather, just bad clothing,
bad,
you know,
coats.
Or, you know, bad yeah. preparation. And the other thing that Cricket is told by Silas is he sits and he draws worlds on the page, and Silas is like, well, as long as you can draw, as long as you can create, like you just created this universe, you know, that we have on the wall, and that, you know, other setting on over there, you can sort of manufacture your own worlds, your own circumstances. You can escape from, you know, some minor annoyance with this other man in the house by, you know, sort of retreating or creating your own world. And I think a lot of people, introverted or semi-introverted kids, would sort of, I think we all knew that, you know?
Yeah.
And I've been, you know, you were running 826 Michigan for many years, and we started 826 Valencia in San Francisco. And it's something I've told kids for 23 years now, which is like, you can, whatever's going on outside your life, you can control what's on the page,
yeah,
and you can control
yours.
Your narrative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you can get it right on the page, and here's who I am, and here's what I want, and here's who I love. And all of that is very controllable, and it's a reason why we teach writing to kids, because outside of it being an empowerment in a society that where words matter and where self-empowerment can come from a young person being able to articulate what they want and need and how the world might be better, you can also say who I am to your teacher, to your parents, to society, and here's what my life is. And so these days, when the horror of giving up one's voice to AI or, you know, thinking that it doesn't matter or thinking that a machine might as well speak for you is the most dystopian thing that's been in the history of humankind. It's the one thing we have is our own voice and our own narrative.
Yeah.
And if you were to cede that to an unthinking machine, then we're cooked. You know, as a human, you're cooked. As a species, we're cooked. It's the one thing we have, which is that separates us from machines and animals, is the ability to tell stories and to make art. Yeah. So anybody that thinks that there's any role for AI to play in any part of the creative process is sadly mistaken.
And everything, I think, in this book, everything between Cricket and Olympia, even when they are not in the same place, it's so human. It's so physical. I mean, there's a lot about physical bodies, which we can talk about in a minute, but there's also this honesty and this humor, which maybe, can you talk about the humor a little bit, about how funny you made them together? Because they really are. And that's the most human thing, is to be able to laugh. You know, AI doesn't ever
get that right. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know if it was just a way that you grew up in, you know, this part of the country in the 70s and 80s, but it was all just ripping each other to shreds for entertainment. Like, it was, you had to have a very thick skin and it moves very fast. And, you know, it's no wonder that, you know, people like Bill Murray grew up down the street from me and David Letterman in Indiana at around the same time. This is where we got our sense of humor, or at least it was reflected by that kind of thing. So Cricket and Olympia have a lot of that kind of banter and that kind of rhythm with each other. And, you know, it is a book about the visual arts and about drawing and about drawing from life and all of that. And which really, I guess it's not, you don't always have that, a lot of overlap with that and humor. You know, it's a very self-serious group of people sometimes. And I think that's much of what I wanted to, you know, some of the themes that are explored is just how, for whatever reason, especially in the 20th century, visual artists felt it necessary to take themselves so seriously, to be able to take the art form seriously. There was no room for any humor whatsoever.
It's like a defensiveness,
It's a defensiveness, yeah. Like, listen, we're going to build it. We're going to prop it up with theory. We're going to prop it up with art speak. We're going to just make sure it's impenetrable.
This is important.
And to tell you, whereas there's really no other art forms that have to take themselves, that have to kind of create this illusion of seriousness to make sure that the person thinks you're serious. Yeah. Which you wouldn't find even in classical music or anything. There isn't this level of pretension in any other art form, nor has there ever been. And it sort of hit its peak in like the 60s, 70s, and maybe early 80s with visual art, where just there would be 280 pages of theory about some painting of that was just done with latex red paint on a canvas and think like, well, all right, you know, if you don't love it, you don't understand it. And there was just this distancing and this just vast buttressing and sort of walls and mirrors and theories and everything to kind of put any doubters in their place. And so it approaches a lot of that. And I think Cricket is a person that loves to just draw the figure and draw traditionally in a way, and wants to learn those techniques that Rembrandt would have known. And it's very hard to find that. And that was the case in the world in the 60s and 70s.
Analog.
It was extremely difficult to find anybody that would teach these things. And luckily, we happen to be now in a period where we're back to a pluralistic approach to visual art. Like any form you want to make art, it's accepted, and you'll find it in contemporary art museums, such as everything, abstraction and representational art and figurative art and conceptual art. It's all on an equal footing, which as it should be. I love all of it. I love conceptual art and I love a lot of abstraction. And, you know, I happen to really love figurative figurative and narrative art too, but there was a time when it was, when there's this sort of pyramid of importance. Yes. And, you know, certain things were very low on it, and then certain things were very high. And you know, of the two characters, you know, Cricket is more of the sort of visceral, handmade, you know, I guess traditional, but also very just kind of, you know, he doesn't feel like he really needs to go far beyond like the human figure because of the beauty, and it's always different and every figure is different, and why not represent something that's so beautiful and in front of us and that we all share? Why do we have to move beyond it? Mm-hmm. Right?
Like, and it's vast. It's a topic that people have been studying for
sure.
How long? Yeah.
And to think that everything, to progress as an art form, we have to eliminate what came before us is very strange. Mm. It's very nihilistic, and it really is uniquely violent in the visual arts. We must destroy what came before.
It's no good. Yeah.
And instead of like, well, we're going to experiment here, but we also have this thing that we've been doing and we know that it works and we're going to shoot out and experiment there. There should be a way to where everybody's welcome. But we did go through a period where it was violently destructive and violently opposed to the past. And that was weird. I came up through that period, and we all look back on it as a period of like incredible a rupture and a sense of that we can't all coexist, that at one point there's a professor that compares some of the people to, you know, the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot and stuff, and just like eliminating anybody that knows how to do anything or knows anything, and the same way that they had eliminated the intellectuals. And
can you talk a little bit about, there's a scene in the book that's this art critique gone absolutely amok, and I would love for you to talk about that.
I think group critiques are one of the worst things humans have ever invented. And if you were going to take a bunch of young, sensitive, extremely sensitive, because artists tend to be some of the more sensitive people on earth, and that's what makes them able to make art. They're sensitive. They sense things. They are delicate. They feel deeply. That's why they're artists, and that's what makes them great and are necessary to a society. And then you put them all, you put 20 of them together, and you say, all right, destroy one of 19 of you. I want you to destroy number 20. And as an adult, I'm going to join in. It's a very, very strange idea. I don't know how it came about. It's totally misguided. There should never, never be a group critique ever again in human
Let's
history.
Let's end them.
They're so sensitive. Kids are so sensitive, and these students are so sensitive. And there's no corollary in human life outside of art school where you sit there and 20 people come at you all at once and just have to say, well, I don't like the upper corner there. And if it's up to 20 people to come up with something to say, they're all going to say something. Oh, I don't like the green part. And that little, I mean, they're going to come up with something.
Yeah.
So then you end up with 20 sets of notes, and they all cancel each other out. None of them are coherent. Some of them are barely thought through. And they've only had 2 minutes to think because they've been looking at the painting for 2 minutes. So it's such a misguided idea. And it just shows like, you know, we've gotten to a point with art education where there's just so many practices that have no basis in, they don't achieve any of the goals that we set out to do. Does a 4-year art school produce a better artist than some other program? And the question is an open one. A lot of times it's not. There might be a different model, go back to the apprentice model, or go back to a lot of these models that existed for 1,000 years. And they might be more conducive to elevating a talented person, making them more able to do what they want to do. Instead, we do find again and again, everyone knows two people. We were talking about a mutual friend of ours that was utterly broken in art school. Yes. And everybody knows 10 of these people that were just broken in half by this process. And so we should learn from that and say, what is the best way to sort of encourage an artist and make them better?
Well,
and I think that there are certainly ways to do it, but a mass abattoir where people come together and just come at each other is definitely not the way.
Not the way. This is the Living Writers Show on WCBN-FM, and we're talking to Dave Eggers today about his new novel, Contrapposto, and we're talking about art school, and I think we're going to hear another song in a minute, but I want to come back to art school, and I want to come back to something we also have in common, which is young writers and encouragement, and sort of how art is made, because we don't need 19 ganging up on the 20th, but we do need encouragement, right?
Yeah.
Like I want to talk about that when we come back, if that sounds good to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
No regrets, Coyote. We just come from such different sets of circumstance. I'm up all night in the studios and you're up early on your ranch. You'll be brushing out a broodmare's tail while the sun is ascending, and I'll just be getting home with my reel-to-reel. There's no comprehending just how close to the bone and the skin and the eyes and the lips you can get. Still feel so alone and still feel related, like stations in some relay. You're not a hit and run driver, no racing away. You just picked up a hitcher, prisoner of the white lines on the freeway. Farmhouse burning down in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. We roll right past that tragedy till we turn into some roadhouse lights where a local band was playing. Locals were up kicking and shaking on the floor. The next thing I know, that coyote's at my door. He pins me in a corner, he won't take no. He drags me out on the dance floor and we're dancing close and slow. Now he's got a woman at home, he's got another woman down the hall. He seems to want me anyway. Why'd you have to get so drunk and leave me on that way?
And that was Joni Mitchell. I'm Amanda Yulee here on Living Writers. We're talking to Dave Eggers this afternoon, getting ready for the release of Contrapposto, his new novel. Can you talk about, in all the books that you've edited, written, been part of, can you talk about that process that we were talking about before, about input from others, encouragement and input? We don't have 19 people coming after you.
I think 19 is great, but this is just very practical advice, uh-huh, because you're a book editor and a book publisher at McSweeney's, and I've been doing that since high school. I was an editor at a literary magazine and then college. And I think one-on-one editing is the key to all everything for me. I love editing books. I know you like editing books. And I love working directly with that author to sort of help them, make it what they want it to be, make it its best self. And if I finish a draft of something, I'll show it to one person. Like, mm-hmm, you see things right after my spouse, Vendela, Vita, who's a novelist, she'll see things first, and then you see them second, usually. And then you go sequentially through. Mm-hmm. And each person will give you some notes. You make the book a little better. You fix a few things. Mm-hmm. They see things that you didn't see, and then you show it to the next person. And I feel like it's the same thing with visual art, with anything. If you go sequentially one-to-one, one-on-one, then you have a very civilized,
yes,
very personal and even private way to improve something. If I were to put up a draft of a book on a screen and have 20 people,
come on,
like, fucked up that part there, and there's a typo there. I mean, you'd feel just embattled, and it's not the right way. But to get you know, other people's perspective on what you've done. I mean, I learned probably more than anything about writing when I was an undergraduate at University of Illinois working for the Daily Newspaper. I never took really any creative writing classes. Mm-hmm. I don't have a degree in creative writing or master's or anything. I worked at the newspaper, and my fellow students who were editors 2 years older than me were unbelievably great editors, and they examined every word and fought every phrase, and like anything lazy, they would hold you to it, hold you accountable. And then one-on-one, we would spend 3-4 hours on a 400-word article or 500-word. And so
one-on-one is the 826 model, really,
right? It's the same thing we do. It's like you set up a tutor with one person, with one young person, and you go through it, and that person's your coach and your champion and your advocate. And we're even more gentle with these students because they're 12 or 14, and who could be more sensitive than somebody that age? But you need that kind of private, quiet way to sort of...
And the writing gets better.
And the writing always gets better.
Yeah.
And so same thing as, you know, there's still MFA programs out there where they'll all critique a story altogether, which seems
nightmarish.
And you'll never hear anybody say, I'm so glad I got 18 sets of notes at once. They really helped me so much.
Well, the premise is that the writing will get better, or the art or whatever it is will get better if everyone agrees that it's good, you know?
And then you just shave down anything interesting about it.
You
really should be ready for at least a third of those people to hate it. And then you might have something interesting. You know, then if you shave down anything objectionable to anybody, like was art by committee ever a good idea? And it becomes art by committee to some extent. Yeah. So I think I love MFA programs, but I really do think that they should be, you should do the same thing, sequential private notes, let's say. And
So Contrapposto is, I think, you know, we've talked about this, takes place over many years, 60, 70 years, and has, for that reason, I think a real timeless quality. But one of the timely things about this book for me is it's is the current events and the politics and the war that takes place in, sort of in the background of parts of this book. How do you think about weaving in real events into fiction? You can maybe talk a little bit about the conflict.
There's, you know, they're in college during the first Gulf War with George Herbert Walker Bush when he invaded, you know, Kuwait, or drove the Iraqis away from Kuwait. And I happened to be in college during that time. Imagine that. And when the draft was a real worry, and you know, I was at a big state school, so I had three friends that went over. They were National Guard, and they only made it as far as Germany, but it was very real. Two of my roommates were gone, you know. And
it's a real thing.
I think that we live in we're so inured to war and conflict and violence here that we forget that this country has only not been at war. Well, we've been around 270 years now, or 60 years, I forget. But around there's only been 15 years we haven't been at war. I mean, so we forget, like,
what is peace?
There was that one, there was that, which one was that? And we forget that close we've been to reinstating the draft here and there. And here we are now, where everybody of draft age is automatically registered now for the draft as of, what, a couple months from now. Mm-hmm. And so I like to not forget that, especially as Americans, we're never very far from some conflict, even if it's on the other side of the world. And and how often we, as a place of welcome, on the other flip side of things, like his first art teacher is a Romanian refugee, and he doesn't quite know that at the time, but we can put it together later. And it just so happens that back then, art people will know that all the classically trained sort of academy, you know, the academies that really taught classical training still were mostly in Europe, Europe somewhat, but even more so Eastern Europe, Russia and China were still teaching classical techniques, and they still do today, but especially in the time when the rest of the world had abandoned that. So Romanian refugee comes back, and that's the only place he can learn sort of some classical techniques. But
yeah,
you can't really, I mean, later there's an interaction with the Bulgarian refugee, and, you know, I think that you don't have to look far to find people who have fled extreme violence or oppression abroad. And
we should say the book also takes place partly abroad. I mean, the book happens in six or seven different places. Yeah.
Cricket as a sort of sheltered Midwesterner with limited prospects ends up traveling the world a lot and really falling in love with sort of remote places and strange occupations, let's say, and anything to do with his hands, really. You know, I think that there's a tactility to working in the visual arts that I think he and a lot of visual artists are like, anything to do with where materiality, where I get to like make something. He's very good with carpentry and anything related to that. It ends up breaking old cruise ships, you know, on the shores of Pakistan, and which is really a thing, you know, all of those ships, they don't just get sunk. They get broken up piece by piece for scrap metal and other things. And so it sort of explores like he doesn't ever have the ambition necessarily to make some of his talents and skills into kind of sort of traditional New York visual art career. But and I don't think he ever misses any of that. He seems like, you know, pretty content wherever he is, as long as he's able to create something or to make something with his hands every day. So there is kind of not a lot of technology in this book, let's say. Having written a couple novels about it, I was really happy to not, you know, have to include
very
any sort
human
of mentions
physical
of,
novel.
Yeah, I mean, it's really weird that, you know, I barely use technology in the modern, in the sense that I think, you know, a lot of people do these days. But so it's strange that I wrote two books about the tech world, because it's really not my life. Or this is a little bit closer to how I live and the things I really love and think about.
Earlier when we were talking, I think you said something about attending art school and then going in a different direction, which I actually wrote down because I thought it was it's funny knowing you, because I think of you as an artist. You are an artist.
Yeah, and I still draw and make prints and paint and stuff, but not in the way that it's not like
you do other things.
Deadly serious practice. I mean, the stuff I make is, I do it for fun. We do it to raise money for some of our nonprofits.
Talk about the fun part.
Because it's always
art is,
fun.
Yeah. What does art do that's
fun? But that's
fun
the thing.
And
this is what Cricket, I think, struggles with. It's like at one point he makes one painting that he loves, and then Olympia, who is his gallerist at the time, is like, well, now you got to make five more. And he's like, well, I wanted to make the one. I don't have five more in me. I'm not going to make a series just to like fill the walls. But that is much of what it takes. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but he won't careerize, I guess, his practice, which I'm not endorsing his way, because I think if he were more serious about it, maybe he'd make a living at it and he wouldn't be shipbreaking in Pakistan. But it is like an honest decision that he's making. And I know plenty of people that love, or that have a lot of talent, that love making art, but they can't make it a career. And I respect that too. And so I think that Olympia and Cricket, obviously, this is the title, contrapposto, like counterposition. These are two people that look at it from different perspectives. And she's much better at making art into a living. And she wants desperately to help him do that too, but he's resistant to it. And I assiduously want to make sure that I'm not saying one is the better way. I think that the reader can really look at and see themselves in either one, or see the point of view in either one of their ways of approaching it. But together, they sort of represent, you know, maybe the two aspects of art making or life in the arts.
Well, there's a lot of back and forth. And I mean, there are times when the reader is frustrated with either of them.
Yeah.
At different times for their approach to this very issue. You know, there are times when Olympia says, just make another painting. Just do it, you know, and he doesn't want to. And you think he should.
Yeah.
It's in his best interest, right?
I mean, it's funny. I did, an old friend of mine since 10 read it, and she was like, well, I didn't like Olympia in this chapter. I was like, well, it was good. You know, this is not a self-help manual.
It's meant to stir emotions.
It's not supposed to tell you
right
how to live. And I think we are, honestly, this is another little commentary, my mini op-eds in the middle of this. But we are in an era, I think more so than others, where people are sometimes forgetting, like, books and novels especially are not the protagonists and are not always behaving as they should.
Yeah. It's a story, first of all.
I hope that we can recognize that. And we don't either. We don't. Oh, they're not. These are not pamphlets about how to go through life. And I find myself more often than ever sort of sometimes talking to folks that are like, well, I didn't really think they should be doing that thing. What is a story? How does a story work if, like, the person wakes up and does the right thing every time, every minute of the lit? Well, there's no story there. So
people forgot about
novels.
Boy,
what about Raskolnikov? Like, what about him? Like, he really, there's some people that have done some bad things in novels before.
Mm-hmm.
What
it's
should
happened.
We do?
It's
but,
happened.
You know, I think if you can see them as human beings, that err and that meander and that change and that come back together and that forgive each other and accept the three-dimensionality of each other and the shared history, and then you might, if you are also such a person of three dimensions and textures and histories
and humanity.
And contradictions, then maybe you'll see something of yourself in these two.
I think people will. We are speaking to Dave Eggers about his new novel, Contrapposto, which is many, many words. And how many illustrations?
No idea.
15 something?
Numbers, I'm not going to.
No, this is
not a
number.
Anytime you ask me a number, the answer is I don't know.
I think it's so rare to have a contemporary novel that's illustrated in the beautiful and important way that this one is. It's just such a gorgeous surprise.
If you want some semi-naked people in your novels.
This is the marketing part of this.
Yes.
We're talking about why you should
buy
the book.
If you like some hints of nudity on the cover, and then some more nudity.
I would call it heavy nudity inside
heavy
the book.
Nudity. Yeah. All right. Amanda calls it heavy nudity.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
You know, this is life drawing. This is what he learns in high school, is to draw from the nude model, which is a revelation for, you know, sheltered kid. But I recommend anybody takes a life drawing class, like tomorrow, because it'll take you 30 to 40 seconds from thinking it's some titillating, interesting, forbidden thing to really just seeing it as shapes and bodies and lines and getting
something
into the
anatomy.
Something
everyone has.
Yeah, and I think that, and especially for high school students, I mean, I took classes in Chicago when I was a young person. I was drawing from the nude, starting at 13, I guess, and nothing is ever mysterious to you after that. Like, it really it's not like it takes romance out of your life or like the fascination with the body or anything. It doesn't remove any of that, but it does. You understand people. You can see a 60-year-old man or woman in front of you and you're 13. You're like, oh, that person is still captivating, beautiful, and their muscles are fascinating. And sometimes you think, boy, that person looks so much younger than I thought they would at 60. And they're so open to me and, you know, all of us in front. It was like,
it's an equalizer.
It's a beautiful experience while also being rigorous art practice. And you're trying to get things, you know, right or make them look interesting. But as a way to empathize with people from all walks of life and, you know, ages and everything, the life drawing classes should be just required at some point, and it also just demystifies the human body too, where especially now when we're, you know, airbrushing everybody or filtering everybody and everybody even more so than the 80s and 90s, having this unrealistic idea of what the body should look like. This is like, oh, it's flawed. There's a scene here in the book in a Parisian atelier, and I thought, well, I should go to Paris and sort of just make sure I have it right. So I went to this really famous studio that's been around for probably open for 150 years without changing at all. And I just walked in last minute. I said, do you have any classes? Oh, there's one going on right now. And I happened in on one. And the woman modeling was easily 85. But to see that, like, how strong she was and how, you know, beautiful she was. And like, there's no mystery to the figure even at, and how, you know, sort of fearless she was, I guess, about showing herself and doing some really interesting poses too. And it's a incredibly empowering experience to have. And you have such infinite respect for the people that do it. And then to see 50 people in that crowd, in that class, all interpreting the body in all of these different ways. It's a central part of the book. So some of Cricket's drawings are in the book. So whether you see it as this, you know, incredibly heightened spiritual experience, or you just want to see some naked drawings, either way,
we have it all.
We've got them in there. With no extra cost.
No.
It comes with the price of the book.
It's just part of the deal. Dave Eggers, thank you so much for joining us on Living Writers. Your first time on the show, although your umpteenth time in Ann Arbor, I believe.
Yes, umpteenth is a good number.
I think that's about right.
I don't like hard numbers.
We don't like to
And
quantify.
I will say for all your readers out there, this is the strangest studio that anyone's ever created. There's paintings on the wall of famous musicians, all of whom look like the undead. They look like all the undead versions of themselves, and they're all done on pegboard, so they all have 40 or 50 holes in their face. So looking at Frank Zappa with 30 holes in his face is really unsettling. And so that's, I guess, the sequel to this. We'll
that's
talk about who made these
conversation that we will
who
have.
Who and why made these portraits, and how are we going to, what kind of nightmares will we have tonight because of them? Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks for being here.
Beanworth, we'll see you now. Right in here, please.
How are we doing here today? All right, just sit back, relax, open your mouth there, and give me a nice big ah.
Ah! I was okay until I heard that waiting room music.
It's so loud in here.
If only you listened to WCBN, you'd hear music like that, and many other good kinds of music as well. Not to mention entertainment, brilliant news and ideas and sports. Tune in, won't you?
Surely you're not talking about WCBN-FM Ann Arbor.
This is a CBN Radio Network presentation.
WCBN FM Ann Arbor.